My name is Dario Hasenstab, I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about the world in the year 2050. Balder, is 2025 too depressing for us and we want to look only into the future from now on?
Hi Dario, well, I don't know if the future is less depressing than the present or the past. Maybe the past is the best way. I still would like to go back to the 1990s. No, I think the deal here today is that given that we see so many rapid changes happening in front of our eyes, especially in 2025 because of all the episodes we recorded on Trump, the Western order is collapsing in front of our eyes. It is an extremely interesting kind of fun experiment to speculate about what the next 25 years are going to bring. With obviously the caveat that we don't have a crystal ball and it's just a speculation. It's not truth-telling, obviously.
I wanted to start this episode by telling the listeners about a meme that I've told you about. And I can very much relate to it kind of when I think about it and see it. And it's basically this picture of someone who's looking a little bit crazy, right? Has the crazy eyes. And it just says, oh, when you've studied history and now you suddenly start walking around everywhere telling everyone, don't you see the signs, right? Because if you know your history from let's say 80 to 100 years ago, there are a few signs out there that might be a bit concerning.
Yeah, so this goes all the way back to the famous quote by Santana, right? The idea that those who don't know history are bound to repeat it. There are all those kinds of quotes along those lines. And absolutely, and this is one of the problems I think that we have right now in 2025, is that there are patterns that we see previously, but the moment you mention those patterns, people can become angry with you because it, for example, seems to lead to you calling Donald Trump, to give an example, similar to Hitler, right? Which is not helpful because obviously, as far as we know, Trump has nothing like a genocidal agenda, and certainly not in the way of Hitler. But there are patterns when it comes to authoritarianism, when it comes to fascism, that are now being seen again, that are clearly visible. That doesn't mean that we're heading towards World War III. It doesn't mean that we're heading towards genocide. But that is the problem when you appeal to history. Basically, people conjure up images, and it's everything or nothing, right? Either it is like 1930s and you're calling Trump a Nazi, or it is nothing like the 1930s. Whereas in reality, the point of history is that there are patterns that will have their unique identity in the present, but they are still somehow similar to the past.
And for today's episode, we're going to combine looking at patterns of history together with, and so we are basically not starting this episode with what is 2050 going to look like, but we're actually going to look back first and see whether we can take some lessons from history for ourselves, right, for our own predictions. And we thought, okay, let's go back in more or less 25 year intervals, close to 100 years back, and we decided to start with 1935. Balder, the year 1935, what an exciting kind of time to look at for history, not to live in. And I want to actually start out with a little fact. What happened on March 13th, 1935? So, right, for transparency reasons, it's March 14th today. And Wikipedia came up with Nazi Germany indirectly banned Jews from working in manual trades when a guild organization was established requiring everyone to pass a master's examination and be entered into a role before they could pursue a manual trade. That is a very convenient fact for us when it comes to kind of looking at, what would someone in 1935 have predicted over the next 25 years? Because they are already the signs on the wall.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a really good era to start with, because what is likely, if you also just look at literature from the time, media from the time, is that there was probably not enough pessimism, obviously, because nobody saw the Holocaust coming, at least not at the level that it actually happens. Nobody serious, I believe, in 1935 wrote something like, in the next 10 years, there's going to be a genocide of 6 million Jewish people. That even Jewish authors were not as pessimistic as they should have been, right? Despite clear, now we know clear signs on the wall that this was where it was heading. And you would have seen, depending on where you are, a world, certainly a Western world, that is still reeling from the 1929 crash, the economic collapse, trying to get back on their feet, and a Western world that is terrified of the Soviet Union and that sees Stalin as the major threat to world peace, to things going wrong, which is exactly one of the reasons why they were less concerned about Hitler, and Hitler could actually expand as quickly as he did with the Anschluss, with occupying Rhineland and Sudetenland and all of those things. So the probable prediction of someone in 1935 would have been something along the lines of there's going to be a war with the Soviet Union, perhaps, if you were British, for example, or if you were American. There would have been predictions about, hey, we're going to recover from the economic downturn. And a lot of people would have said, look at what Mr. Hitler is doing in Germany. It seems to work in some way, right? Creating autobahns, investing in a manufacturing sector. Things seem to be going better in Germany than they used to. And so there would have been a completely misplaced optimism about those things and a misplaced pessimism about the danger of the Soviet Union and communism.
When you say a person in 1935 would have been concerned about going to war with the Soviet Union, are you talking about intellectuals or are you talking about the average person on the street? Because, I mean, this was only 15 years after the end of World War One. So most of them, if they weren't born afterwards, have already experienced a world war. So I don't know. I imagine that after a war, the appetite for another war must be rather low.
Well, you're absolutely right. Certainly in countries like France, right? France was a country that had absolutely no interest. And even though they on paper had a big military, the country absolutely was not ready to engage in another war. And the British establishment as well. But that is mostly focused on Germany. I think you're right that maybe the prediction wasn't there's going to be a direct war with the Soviet Union. The major threat seemed to be a revolution in Germany, in France, like the revolution in Russia, right? There was this enormous fear that communism was like, if you like, a virus from a liberal capitalist perspective that was spreading around the world and that was engulfing nations. And so there was a lot of fear in Britain, in France, in Germany, that somehow communists would take over just like they did in 1917 in Moscow. And that was where most predictions would be heading to. Now, to a certain extent, they wouldn't have been completely wrong, but because 20 years later, we find ourselves in the Cold War. But I don't think it would have been common or even to a certain extent reasonable for people to say, hey, you know what, in the next 10 years, we're going to have the biggest war the world has ever seen. It's going to span all over the globe. For one reason, namely that it's very difficult to predict such major disaster. That disaster it's not visible until it occurs, right?
Well, let's move from basically a fear of something like the Cold War to the actual early stages of the Cold War to the year 1960. And for the year 1960, I have a lovely little fact. Just because it compares so well to the one from exactly 25 years earlier, and again, I went to Wikipedia here, my most trusted source, of course, that West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer met with Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, the first time a German leader had conferred with a leader of the Jewish state. Right, so just within these 25 years, you go from, okay, we're starting to exclude Jews from society in Germany to kind of a like reapproach of relations after the Holocaust.
Yeah, and what is very interesting there is that, of course, that's a very short period of time, but at the same time, it shows how quickly Germany evolved, right? Or Germany turned into basically the biggest Israeli ally. because of the past. This was a time that Germany was actively already helping in 1960 to hunt down Nazis that were still walking on this planet, right? There was a very practical, clear alliance developing between Germany and Israel, even though, of course, the emotional tension would have still been there. But it was completely obvious from an Israeli perspective that Germany was useful, right, in 1960 to actually somehow establish the Israeli state, because in those days Israel was by no means certain of its existence. This was before 1978, this was before the Camp David Accords, so this was at a time that a lot of people would have predicted that at some point Israel may actually be once again wiped off the map. And Israel knew that they needed long-term allies, and Germany was a very clear candidate for that, despite the dark history that only had happened a generation previously.
But at the same time, the world is, as I said a few minutes ago, right, is in the, well, at the beginning of the Cold War. So there was, right, that fear. I mean, if we try to go into the mindset of someone who would predict the next 25 years of, what happens if this Cold War becomes a hot war? We've just had two world wars. I imagine that in the 1960s, the kind of hunger for war must have been even lower than in 1935.
Absolutely. And it was also a time that there was a clear kind of ideological divide in the world. And it was obvious that that divide was sort of balancing itself out, right? There was a situation where the reality, strategic reality, was one of a West that had a relatively clearly defined approach to global affairs and a Soviet Union that had something similar. And in that situation, given that it was a relative stalemate in terms of power, slowly it became clear that the Soviet Union was the lesser in terms of military might and economic might. And of course, we now know that the Soviet Union would collapse, but that was not clear in the 1950s. It was one in which there was, certainly from a Western perspective, clear light versus clear darkness, but light couldn't conquer darkness yet, right? And that was scary because that meant that there was no obvious solution. Nobody was thinking that a war necessarily would immediately break out, but the fear of actually nuclear weapons destroying the entire planet was real and was in many ways justified. And a lot of people predicted that a nuclear war would actually break out. And to a certain extent, with, for example, the Cuban Missile Crisis, a few times we were pretty close to that.
Again, I wasn't alive back then, but I was alive in the early, when was this? I think in 2014, that word YOLO, right? You only live once, trended amongst the youth. I imagine that in 1960, you have that attitude, right? Is, hey, we might die in a nuclear war tomorrow. So might as well, right? I mean, after World War II, things are starting to pick up again. Might as well get rich, right? And might as well start doing well, because that's exactly what what that generation did, is they did phenomenally for themselves in the West.
Right, but this was also the time that the civil rights movement rose up, that there was a increase in feminist literature and in feminist influence within politics, that there was these kind of culture wars, right? Now we talk about culture wars. The 1960s were true culture wars, where it was like tribes going at it, and one tribe clearly trying to modernize society and eventually winning, right? Both in terms of feminism, in terms of, you know, defeating patriarchy, in terms of racism, in terms of all these kinds of traditional pillars that needed to be broken down to set up a more modern society. So it was a very strange and very kind of important time in the evolution of the West. Again, when it comes to predictions, I think there's a big difference here if you take 1965 or 1955, right? We mentioned 1960. 1955 would have been much more about, oh, my prediction is that at some point World War III will take place, even though we don't want it, we're not ready for it, but it's unavoidable because it's a fight of light versus dark, darkness. In the 1965, probably the conversation was more about, We are moving towards a world where social matters are being resolved differently than they are now, where, you know, the I Have a Speech Dream by Martin Luther King, the idea, sorry, did I say that correctly? I Have a Dream Speech by Martin Luther King, my apologies. you know, the positive energy of John F. Kennedy, this idea like we are now actually moving towards a world that is more just, that is different, despite the Cold War basically hanging like a dark cloud over us all.
Well, and you also had the moon landing, right? I mean, in the early 60s, or am I wrong about this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. 1968, well, not early 60s, 1968, I think. Gagarin was before that, of course. And even though that was in a geopolitical context, it was in the context of, you know, geopolitics and basically the Soviet Union and the United States getting one over on the other, basically showing that they were technologically more advanced and more capable. What it did do is it led to a lot of hope and imagination about the future, because it showed what humanity was capable of, right? Even though it was in the context of defeating the enemy, it was also just incredibly impressive that human beings could go into space, and that then after that, human beings could walk on the moon. It gave a lot of hope and positivity. So in some ways, predictions in the 50s would have been radically different than in the 60s. In the 50s, they would have been overly negative. In the 60s, they may have actually been relatively accurate, right? Like, because it's exactly what we saw later. We saw humanity that started developing all kinds of technological know-how, making a lot of social progress. And I think that everyone probably would agree that the 1990s were an enormous improvement on the 1960s. So you have in the late 1960s, a generation that actually has good reason to be optimistic, and their predictions might have actually been the most accurate of the bunch.
And from this moving towards 1985, right, and back another 25 years, here I'm cheating a little bit because I'm going to March 11th, actually, because March 11th, very conveniently for us, well, for the story here, it was the day that Mikhail Gorbachev became general secretary of the Soviet Communist Party, and therefore the de facto leader of the Soviet Union, right, kind of giving you a glimpse of hope, thinking that, oh, you know, hey, this Cold War thing wasn't all that, I mean, it was very exciting, but not in a positive way. And now we're actually moving into some time of reform, and this is actually a person we can kind of get behind and believe in.
Yes, this is also the time that for the first time I, as a child, became a little bit aware of international relations, not in any serious way, but I remember Gorbachev basically shaking up our perspective on the Soviet Union, and there was a lot of positivity towards him. I still think that history in many ways has been a little bit too critical of him, because he, you know, he was quite consistent, but he was also a true believer in communism, so he found it difficult to just completely give up on a system, even though the system was not working, was dying. He gave quite a bit of hope in the 1980s, but it wasn't just Gorbachev. It was also clear, even before him, that the Soviet Union was in trouble. And so this, you see in the 1980s, and certainly in the late 1980s, a real sense that we're moving into a new era, right? The Cold War is nearing its end. And that was clear in 1987, 88, or at least there was significant hope. I don't think people would have foreseen how quickly it would then go, like the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. And then by 1993, the Soviet Union ceased to exist. You know, that's a period of 4 years. I don't think any prediction would have said it would go that far, because the Soviet Union was an enormously powerful and intimidating global creature, if you like. However, there was a sense that we could actually stop worrying about the bomb for the first time in many decades. And you see a lot of the literature going in that direction, right? Media, but also authors of books describing a world post Cold War, not necessarily post Soviet Union. I don't think the predictions was that the Soviet Union was going to disappear, but more that the Soviet Union would reform into something less threatening and more, you know, accessible from a Western perspective. And so if you had written a book, what is the next 25 years going to look like? You would have said, hey, you know what? Technological change is clearly coming. The Soviet Union is no longer going to be a major threat from a Western perspective. So we're moving towards a world that's more peaceful, that's more hopeful, where we can dream about the future and we can sort of work together to improve humanity as a whole, right? There was also more awareness of that colonialism was probably had not been the greatest thing, and that we needed to now sort of remedy that. We needed to look at our neo-colonial behavior. And so there was a lot of optimism, which then translated in the 1990s, which probably from a Western perspective was the happiest decade that we have experienced.
I mean, it was because you spoke about technological change, right? And I know you're a big chess fan, so I just want to throw in the fact that that was also the year where, for the first time, a computer beat a chess grandmaster, right? And I think that's another one of those little headlines that maybe occupies the front page of a newspaper for one day, but not maybe not much longer. But it's very symbolic of, hey, technological change is here, and look how amazing the prospects of this might be. Not really kind of understanding what that might really mean for the world.
Right, but actually, I think you would be surprised by what a big deal this was. Yes, I like chess, so I paid, and my father liked chess, so we paid more attention to this. But actually, it was really, really big news. There were a number of interesting things going on here. So there was an understanding, humanity understood that the fact that they'd created a machine that could beat a human being at chess, not just any human being, but the best player that the world has probably ever known, Garry Kasparov, was a major, major sign of things to come. And we didn't know exactly how or what, but we knew that it was big. And yes, it was symbolic, but it actually occupied a lot of our imagination. And it wasn't just one-day headlines. It was many weeks and months that people wrote about it. And entire books were written about it. What does the future of AI hold? That kind of thing, right? At the same time, what was very interesting about it was that it was a Russian grandmaster signaling that, you know, it was now Kasparov basically represented humanity, and it didn't matter because the Cold War was done, right? We were no longer, previously, chess had become a tool for Cold War dynamics. It was the Fischer, you know, defeating Russian grandmasters was a major Cold War aspect of that time. And the fact that now we were thinking about it in a post-Cold War perspective, looking at it from, hey, this is humanity versus technology, and what does this mean for technology, and what are we going to see in the future, was a big, big deal. Broadly speaking, I think that everyone was aware that the 21st century was going to be very technologically heavy. Changes went very quickly. 1980s had car phones, right? Not mobile phones, but phones you could phone from your car if you were rich enough or if you were a businessman or something like that. So technology was evolving very, very quickly. That then turned into mobile phones. I was actually working in a shop in the early 1990s, selling the first consumer mobile phone in the Netherlands that was still sold by then the nationalized telecoms company in the Netherlands. There was a very quick evolution of things. We started to talk about the internet. We started talking about what does it actually hold. And we could imagine a world where all of a sudden we could access a library from New York, or we could access documents or books written by someone else. Star Trek had already made predictions about how people can look at each other when they call each other, right? How you would actually see the image of the other person in front of you when having a conversation. All those kinds of things were being theorized. And I think the biggest problem that people had in predicting the future was that they were too optimistic about it. Not the size of the change. Everyone knew the size was going to be enormous. But people didn't realize the potential danger in terms of social media, in terms of mental health, in terms of the death of intellectualism and those kinds of things.
Because if you look at the following 25 years, right, there's first kind of 10 years of relative optimism, right? I mean, we've quoted it many times, but Francis Fukuyama and the end of history. So you have these 10 years of, hey, things are going well. And then I would describe, like, the official turning point I would describe as 9/11. Then you have the war on terror. You have a bunch of other wars. Then you kind of have the 2008 financial crisis. So suddenly things are going into a different direction. Not, I don't think as intensely as we are witnessing right now, but you have kind of like 10 years of, yay, let's do this. And then another 10 years of, oh, okay, not as cool as we thought.
Yeah, no, exactly that. You have the 1990s or certainly the early 90s, and then you've got the 2000s, and you see this immediate adjustment in our attitude towards the world. And we still, even in the 2000s, we didn't know exactly what the problem would be, but we started seeing potential darkness, right? Now, by the way, some listener might point out that there were authors who were, you know, predicting technological collapse or the rise of the robots, you know, Skynet, or the Terminator films. There were some really weird kind of concerns that in the end turned out to be complete nonsense. For example, the year 2K bug. I vividly remember, because by that time I was an adult, that people generally were terrified that once the year 2000 would hit, that all the computers would stop working and airplanes would fall out of the sky, because the clock would no longer be able to acknowledge the new century, because they'd all been programmed from 0 to 99 and not to 100 or not to 1000. So basically there was a lot of obsession with small little things like that. There was concern that has been completely debunked about how video games would turn us all into murderous genocidal maniacs. That obviously hasn't happened, because video games don't affect our psychology in that way. So there were specific concerns and predictions that turned out to be wrong about the negative side of technology, whereas we didn't see the actual dangers, namely that people would become addicted to social media streams, would get all their information from social media. And that is something where everyone would have been completely, completely off, right, in terms of predictions. Because I remember thinking and talking about this and reading about this, that, hey, the internet is coming, and we were all going to be much wiser, much better informed, much more understanding of the complexity of the world. Why? Because we could actually just go to a website and find out everything we needed to know about everything. So obviously we were going to be some kind of humanity 2.0 that was going to be amazing and much better at understanding how to deal with problems. And we basically were facing a 21st century that was going to be utopian, because we would take all our intellectual and other resources and put it to good use, make sure that humanity would benefit. And that's where we completely got it wrong, because instead of that, the internet has created the death of basically world knowledge. It's turned people more ignorant, which is something no one saw coming.
Well, but that wasn't the case in 2010 yet, at least not the general broad consensus, right? Because, okay, now 2010, hello, I'm alive as well. for the first time in us going down this route. And of course, I was very young, but I was already consuming the news and kind of aware of things happening globally. And I remember 2008, right? It was kind of one of those first global events I do remember, because it was somewhat concerning, but not really affecting us. But then you have 2010, and I described it in before that, hey, you have the World Cup of 2010. The world is visiting South Africa. You have Shakira singing. Everyone is kind of happy and so on. And I would say that there was still a general sense of optimism, right? You had this, I mean, Facebook was still a good thing. Young people were still on Facebook. Other apps weren't invented yet. So I would say that in 2010, you kind of have a bit more realism compared to maybe 1985, right? Where it's like, okay, not all was great, but we've done some mistakes and I think we can learn from them. So let's move into the future, right? And let's actually, right? So there was like some general optimism, some relative optimism. I remember this feeling of the world's getting a little bit closer, right? Kind of everyone celebrating, yay, again, waka waka. Then Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize, yay, right? We have Obama in the White House. It seems like we've solved racism, right? So those very naive, happy thoughts that I feel like were there in 2010. And I'm not sure whether anyone in 2010 really predicted than the year 2025 that we're in right now. And I mean, there's still another 10 years to go that they would have needed to predict. But I'm not sure whether they would have predicted the end of liberal democracy.
No. And I think what you're describing is exactly that relatively short period of time where optimism took hold because people were fed up with all the negativity and the darkness from the decade before. So exactly as you described, so you had the really optimistic 1990s. Then in the 2000s, you've got a realization, hang on, we might have some problems. And 9/11 was, of course, an incredible wake-up call in that sense. But also technologically, we're starting to see a certain darkness, certain problems. And you see literature coming out about potential problems. But then by 2010, after the economic crisis of 2008, after the war on terror, the war on terror is finally seems to be dying out. You've got the Arab Spring coming up in 2011. There seems to be a wave of political optimism like, okay, we've now had a bad decade. Let's go back, get back on track of the 1990s. And that is, I think, what you're describing, that kind of going back to the hope of the 1990s that we could work it out. Having said that, I think it would have been slightly easier than in the 80s or 90s to predict the problems because you could see a lot of the things that you see now in 2025 already occurring then. Yes, Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, but you already had Donald Trump and others, Sarah Palin, talking about how Obama's birth certificate was not real and how he wasn't really an American. You have a lot of populist politicians in the United States and elsewhere, Le Pen in France, coming up. You've got the start of a really aggressive anti-immigrant rhetoric. So, yes, I think there was this short span of time, maybe 2010 to 2012 or something like that.
I would argue until 2014-15, right? Because I think it's that it's Obama gets reelected, right? A bit more realism, maybe. Nobody's still as excited about him. There's not a second Nobel Peace Prize for just being elected. And then 2015, right? You have that 14, the rise of ISIS. I think that's maybe the time when there's not that much optimism of the world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's difficult to put your finger on it, but already by that time, so the Arab Spring died out very, very quickly. It turned out that overthrowing Gaddafi wasn't a great idea. In any case, yes, there was a short period of time of that optimism, and then we moved towards the world that we know now. But I would argue that a good analyst, I certainly didn't write about this, so I can't claim credit here, but a good analyst could probably have seen in 2010, 2012, the writing on the wall. And there were people who did. There were people who actually warned about a lot of these dynamics. Whereas it would have been very difficult to live in 1989 or 1999 and actually do the same, right? But now we're talking about basically modern times. We're talking about your generation. We're talking about the thing. The problems we're observing in 2025. One interesting observation here, and this is, I'm basically basing this on Jonathan Haidt, who is this psychologist, this author, very famous American author, who quite convincingly shows that by 2013, 2014, there is this switch in mental health among children because they now become addicted to social media. They become addicted to phones, teenagers. But it's very specifically in 2013, 2014 that the world actually turns darker in terms of how young people experience their existence, how they experience their surroundings. And until that year, until 2013, there's little evidence that generations were affected.
Well, speaking of mental health amongst the youth, let's talk about the year 2025. But before we kind of jump into predicting what will 2050 look like, I think it makes sense to look back at the four periods in time that we've just talked about and see whether there's any lessons we can take from that for our state of mind right now, right? Because as we kind of said, hey, a few of these a few of these generations, maybe they were too optimistic, maybe they weren't
optimistic enough, maybe they were not pessimistic enough. I think those lessons are really important to kind of take or to learn right now before we go and predict 2050, because otherwise I fear that someone might record a podcast in 2075 and make fun of us for not being properly aware of the feelings that we might be feeling that we are not aware of.
Well, yeah, it's important to realize that typically foreign policy analysts don't predict exactly for that reason, right? Because the chances that you look a fool afterwards are quite high in that sense. It's also important, I think, if we look back at the lessons, to distinguish between sort of long-term patterns that create either over-optimism or not enough optimism or not enough pessimism, etc., versus kind of very difficult to foresee events, right? Some events are just almost unpredictable. There's things that, yes, maybe if you'd been super clever and super lucky, you would have gotten it right. Like I could now, for example, predict that Switzerland starts an aggressive foreign policy and starts, you know, threatening Austria. You know, if that happens to come true, then I look like the biggest genius, but it's not based on any realistic pattern that we're seeing. So essentially, predictions are always very scary, and we have to give credit to previous generations in that sense that, of course, it's really hard to get it right. But the structural patterns from the past are very useful for us. And if you look at the 1930s, for example, and there's a lot of similarities that people draw a lot of parallels with now in the 1930s, 100 years ago. We even just did that 20 minutes ago. I would argue that the problem with the 1930s was that people weren't pessimistic enough. People were not particularly optimistic, but they didn't see the darkness coming, right?
Is that something you see right now? Because maybe in my circles, it's definitely that everyone is very pessimistic now particularly about the medium-term future, right? That's like, oh, all right, with the world kind of drifting apart, authoritarian on the rise. Do you think that this could happen to us, that we are currently not pessimistic enough and we are missing a world war that's around the corner?
No, I agree with you. I think people are, and we as well, are generally quite pessimistic at the moment. And maybe that is in large part because we know what happened in the 1930s and we're all terrified that something like that's going to happen again. So maybe we put too much weight on that scenario because we know what it could lead to, right? If you have two scenarios, and one is your day is going to be just normal and boring and whatever, and the other scenario is that there's going to be a bomb falling on your roof, then you're going to put more emphasis on that scenario of the bomb falling on your roof, because that is something that is much, much more impactful. So I think in many ways, because we know the 1930s happened, maybe we are overly pessimistic in that sense.
Well, one other lesson that I would take this time from the 1950s and 1960s is, because we talked about how quickly kind of the perspective changed, right, or shifted, is, and that's something that at least, right, I mean, okay, my life has not been as long yet, but I feel like in the last few years, things have shifted very quickly, right? So that's something that I can definitely take into account, because if you have asked me to make a prediction about 2050 in 2018, it would have looked very different from now.
Yeah, and that is very clear in that period, right? So as we just discussed, the 1950s, kind of very pessimistic about the Cold War. We're all going to die in an atomic explosion. And the 1960s, all of a sudden, because of the civil rights movement actually taking hold and a big social change happening, the Beatles being on air, and then the hippie movement in the early 70s, all of a sudden there was a kind of optimism about, hey, you know what, the world might not be as bad as we thought it was. At least we see some real, real success in terms of bringing down patriarchy, institutional racism, etc. And then, of course, you see in the decades afterwards that, yes, some of that comes true. Some of that optimism of the 60s was absolutely warranted. But it probably didn't lead to the utopia that people were hoping of. You know, Martin Luther King's speech that I just fumbled before, having a dream, I have a dream, has not yet been realized. institutional racism and just practical day-to-day racism is still very much alive, for example, right? And we're now half a century further. So in that sense, there is this sort of back and forth between not being pessimistic enough, then overly optimistic. And then in the years afterwards, people became a little bit high on their own success as well, right?
Which I don't think that can happen to us, at least not to two of us, because the entire idea of this podcast is to look back at the last 30 years, 35 years, and say, well, people were too high on their own success and they weren't critical enough. So I'm not sure whether that, and also I don't see any success surrounding us at the moment. It would be very difficult for me to see anything that they were seeing.
It's obvious that we are in danger of being too critical, because this whole podcast was set up as a critique, if you like, rather than a criticism of Western policymaking, Western thinking, the Western bubble. So that's true. It's not as if we're going to say, oh yeah, the West has been great and we're going to do fine again. So if anything, once we're going to make predictions, we have to make sure that we don't go down the route of the 1950s. But we're not in danger of being overly optimistic or saying, hey, things are going great.
Well, what I think I personally am in danger of is what we saw in the year kind of 2010 and following, because I do think that I'm still very much coping with everything that's happening. And I think there are moments, right, so when we record not, but in between, right, there are moments when I still think, well, you know, we might turn it around, and there's like maybe a positive development here, positive development there, and everything will be okay again, right? We will kind of be fine, right? I think that's at least out of these things the greatest risk I see for myself personally now when it comes to making a prediction.
Yeah, and so that's exactly that time period that we saw, and that's what we're in danger of, right? That we want to typically see something constructive on the horizon. We want to believe that there's something that we can do to make the world still a better place. Sometimes that's absolutely true as well, that exists, that path is in front of us. But sometimes that path isn't there, and then we're just, you know, dealing with that copium. We're trying to find ways that we don't have to go to bed crying at night. I think that a lot of that literature that came out in the early 2010s, you know, that literature that said, hey, statistically, you're better off than at any time in history. Things are looking great.
Yeah, where have those books gone? I feel like those books are no longer being written,
right? Yeah, you know, because they were peddlers in optimism that didn't make actually any sense. They tried to point out that GDP had grown, or that more money was spent on education or things like that. But if you actually looked at the underlying dynamics, the mental health, that was very quickly going down the drain during that time period, right? So it was basically people trying to think in constructive terms and saying, hey, if you're too pessimistic, you're not helping, you're just hurting our long-term future. And that is, you know, that's all very nice, but sometimes you have to be realistic about where we're going. And sometimes it's really hard to have sort of a slap in the face and say, look, things are terrible. What are we going to do about it?
So are the two of us not pessimistic enough at the moment, or should we be a little bit less pessimistic? And I'm not even talking about optimistic.
No. So obviously the answer to that is that neither, in the sense that our objective should not be to be either more or less pessimistic. Our objective should be to really look at the variables we have in front of us, to see at the to look at the actual structure and make sure that our predictions, if you like, our discussion of what 2050 looks like is based on the reality as we see it. If the question becomes, should we clean our lens a little bit? Is our lens too muddy and too negative? And do we need to sort of adjust for that? If anything, I would argue that based on this podcast, maybe we have to be careful not to become too pessimistic, right? Maybe pessimism is the biggest danger for us, for you and me here.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried looking at the time. I think we are already kind of at the 45-minute mark that we usually record at. So what I would propose is that we actually continue this conversation for next week, and we will just leave you, the audience, with a little bit of a hook, right? So I mean, what are we seeing, right? We're seeing a mix of a polar, like a multipolar world, right? The rise of AI is something we, I think, we need to take into account for our predictions. The demise of liberal democracy, global oligarchy, right? Will we all have to hail Elon Musk in the future? And then in general, just shifting geopolitics. But I think what we will make of that, you'll have to listen to us next week, because we are unfortunately out of time, and therefore I think this is a great moment to end today's conversation, preparing ourselves for how we will make our predictions next week. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made, or you want to actually submit your own predictions, right? And please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble and give our predictions. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I took a quote from the great Ray Bradbury, of course, author of Fahrenheit 451, who wrote, "I don't try to describe the future, I try to prevent it."